Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Alva.
I'm Ben.
On today's New Statesman podcast, Ben Walker, our polling guru, talks about public opinion on the government, COVID restrictions, and the cost of living.
Right, just to interrupt, before we start the podcast proper, I want to bring in this extra bit of breaking content. So after we had recorded this month's polling update with Ben Walker of Britain Elects and the New Statesman's data team, there was a rather eventful weekend in polling. So we thought we would get Ben back in to talk about that. So thanks for joining us again, Ben.
Happy to be here.
Just talk us through, you know, what we've seen over the last 48 hours, as it were.
Yeah, so over the weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you often get a slew of polls, either for the Sunday papers or off their own bat. And we've seen quite some sudden shifts in public opinion. Field work happening mostly over the 7th, 8th, 9th and 10th of December. So it's all happening at the same time. And they all seem to be quite instantaneous impulse reactions to the revelations about the Christmas party. Now that we have photo evidence of a party, I can only imagine that this issue isn't going to go away. So what we have right now, you have Labour leads, some of the highest since 2014. You have Opinion giving a Labour lead. That's the highest since February 2014. And then you have big Labour leads like 8 points, 7 points, 9 points. It's quite significant. But I should emphasise, though, field work. It's taken over a free... It feels quite impulsive at the moment. If you want to be able to call this a trend, we need to see the same numbers in about a week's time. So I don't want to pour some cold water over Labour activists, but I would just say just hold your nerve.
Yeah, in terms of what we have seen over the weekend, previous poll shifts towards Labour have been predominantly poll shifts of Conservatives going, don't know. And so Labour goes up in percentage terms while staying flat in real terms. Now, one thing which was tended to happen in the past is people who say don't know, revert back to their previous habit, which is why people get much more excited when they have direct transfers from one party to another. Have we started to see any direct transfers in this week, this weekend's set of polls?
In every single poll, normally you have about 3% of Labour voters going Tory and 3% of Tory voters going Labour. Cancel each other out pretty much. And you have that throughout most parliaments. Recently, though, we've started to see something quite significant. So in the most recent Opinion one, you have about 1 in 10 voters that voted Tory in 2019 now saying they're going to vote Labour. You also have 1 in 10 Tory voters from 2019 also saying they're going to vote for the Reform Party. You have basically a Tory base that has lost confidence. Of those who are intending to vote, 1 in 10 Labour, 1 in 10 Reform. But then you have about 1 in 4 of the entire base saying they're not sure who they're going to vote whatsoever. Something worth considering. Much of it, yes, is down to Tory voters going undecided rather than Tory voters going to another party. We're still seeing that, but it started to tick up the transfers from Tory to Labour. Again, not sure how set in stone this is. I say wait a week, wait a month maybe. If this continues, then this is serious. This is quite a sea change. I'm not confident enough to say that now, but something worth bearing in mind is that where this voter uncertainty is coming from is not from the seats the Labour Party lost in 2019. It's coming from the old base, not the new base built by Boris Johnson. It's coming from parts of the South, very safe Tory Shire seats, not so-called Red Wall, not, you know, South Yorkshire, Yorkshire Coalfields, the North East. This voter uncertainty is very much seems to be the reserve of its old base.
Thanks. I guess my kind of final question is, obviously we have a by-election at the end of the week. And one of the things that we can sometimes use by-elections as a useful sort of temperature check are, you know, are the national polls about right? And Old Bexley and Sidcup indicated the answer was yes. Assuming that the national polls are about right, what would we expect to see in North Shropshire?
North Shropshire's a bit of an enigma in that it shouldn't be a Lib Dem target. It voted 60% leave, and I tend to think that matters. If the polls were right, you'll be looking at a Tory hold. We're you know, down 15 points at the last election. That's what if listeners go to Britain Predicts, which is on the New Statesman website, you'll be able to find yourself what the model thinks for North Shropshire, and is Tory hold. That's what we're expecting. I sort of buy that in that I think, yeah, it's a Leave seat. I think that still matters to a lot of voters. I think that Leave voting identity is still strong. I think the Lib Dems have burnt their bridges. You can see that in the fact they made no gains in Cornwall earlier this year. I really still think that matters. I think if taken in isolation, sleaze, Boris Johnson's own personality, the notion that voters can deal a blow to Boris Johnson personally by voting for the anti-Tory party, the Lib Dems, or Labour, if you believe in some of the internally nonsense polling leaked. I think voters might do it, but I just think it's much less likely than Chesham and Amersham, and much less likely than Old Bexley and Sidcup. Which, to tell you the truth, I thought that was more of a, you know, likely. I thought that would have been more trouble for the Tories than North Shropshire.
Right, back to the podcast.
Hi, Ben. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
And I think we're going to make this a regular feature, aren't we? We're going to hear from you each month on the latest in polling.
I'm so sorry for that.
So there's a lot to get stuck into in terms of public opinion today. Why don't we start with the obvious? How are the public feeling about the government after this terrible few weeks, actually, of scandal that they've had, particularly over the alleged Christmas party?
Oh, Christ. Well, how long has it been happening? Over a month now?
Yeah.
More than a month? Just every week you have had some form of story relating to sleaze come up, whether it be about a minister, faceless, nameless in the eyes of much of the public, or indeed about the Prime Minister, which is slightly more serious. At the start, there was just enough takes from enough people that it's not going to matter in the red wall, so-called. It's not going to matter across the country, when in reality, well, you know what? It does, actually. And what we've seen, let's just look at the headline voting intention numbers, right? So about a month, 2 months ago, you had the Conservatives about 5, 6, 7 points ahead of Labour. That was partly a consequence of Labour's base not entirely being enthusiastic, the Tories being pretty enthused. Now we're sort of seeing the polar opposite. Right now, the polls are neck and neck. According to our own poll tracker, it's literally a 0.1 point difference, basically, between Labour and the Conservatives. And the reason for that, basically, is Tory voters who voted Tory in 2019, I said it in the previous podcast, they just aren't sure who they're sticking with now. There's no confidence amongst them to stick with the Tories. They're not moving to Labour. Hardly any of them are moving to Labour. About 3% of those that voted Tory in 2019 say they are back in the Labour Party, which is nothing compared to the number of 2005 Labour voters who said they were going to back David Cameron's Tory party in 2010. Mm-hmm. So really, there's not much vote transfers going on the top. What's just happening is that the Tory base is very unenthused by this. They're not keen about voting Conservative. They're not keen about voting Boris Johnson. But Labour's not exactly benefiting from that. They're gaining by default, basically.
That's so interesting, Ben, because this is why it's great that we'll be having you on every month, because I wanted to ask you about this after the last one where, you know, the last time we spoke, Labour and the Tories were roughly neck and neck, but you were explaining that is, as you say, because of a collapse in Tory support, particularly among 2019 Conservative voters. So the proportion of don't knows is going up, and that's what's driving the shift. But it's fascinating to me that, you know, there was a snap poll giving Labour a 4-point lead. We're recording on Thursday, the 9th of December. This will come out a little bit later. But, you know, there was a snap poll last night indicating a Labour lead. It's so interesting that is still not really driven by actually people switching support to Labour. I think people will find that, you know, fascinating.
Absolutely. And Labour strategists should not in any way be complacent or even happy about this. The 4-point Labour lead, it's good. It's the biggest the pollster Redfield and Wilton has ever done. Not the biggest we've seen so far. ComRes had a 6-point Labour lead, but that was a bit of an outlier there. But again, it's just driven by, as you say, as I've said, as everyone's now saying, really, 2019 Tory voters just saying they're undecided. But it's a big jump. So Redfield and Wilton on Monday showed around about 10 to 15% of the Tory base unsure. Now that's up to 25%. So 1 in 4 people that backed the Tories in 2019, they're not keen about it anymore.
So we'll talk about the sort of ups and downs of snap polling in the next section. But there was also a snap poll, I think you might have seen, Ben, from ComRes, that a majority of people think Boris Johnson should resign over this Christmas party story. What do you make of that?
Oh, yeah. So thing about snap polling, we've had one of those questions, didn't we, about what people thought of snap polling on Twitter. Basically, when you look at snap polling, 4-point Labour lead recently, as you say, 50, 60-something percent of people say they want Johnson to resign. Always bear in mind that snap polling is instinctive. It's sudden. It's snap. Well, that is what it says. It's basically people giving, what would I say, an erratic response? Not erratic.
Impulsive.
Yes, that's the word. Sorry. Yeah, an impulse decision, basically. And impulse decisions aren't often what you do in the ballot, in the polling station, because you have hours and time to think about that, right? So here's another example. Rewind back to the days after the EU referendum of 2016, right? And in the immediate day after, a Scottish paper commissioned a pretty unknown market research firm to survey on Scottish independence. And it was 60-40 yes. Right, 60% of Scots wanted Scotland to be independent in the immediate aftermath of the EU referendum. A few days later, he had Savation ask it, and it was 55-45 yes. A month later after that, it was 55-45 no. But what we're sort of seeing with snap polling, yes, as you say, impulse decisions. It's not often representative of what you're thinking long term, but it's a nice indication of what people are thinking in isolation, if that makes sense. So if Scotland, if Brexit was taken in isolation, Scots wouldn't be happy about it. They would want to vote for independence. But when they take time to think, they're less sure. So I think whilst obviously you have 60-something percent saying Boris Johnson should resign, I would say the actual number is a bit lower than that in the weeks and months to come, will be lower in the weeks and months to come.
Okay, and obviously some new COVID restrictions have been announced recently. How is the public feeling in terms of compliance?
What we saw over the summer months was the number of Brits concerned with the pandemic go lower and lower. It's the lowest it's ever been, right? And the number of Brits concerned with the economy, with prices, with getting back to normal, rise and rise over time. And so the country is determined, is desperate to get back to normal. And so all announcements of new restrictions aren't being met favourably. The public don't really want that. But the impression is they're sort of willing to wear it. At the moment, as many Brits are scared of catching the coronavirus as there were just days before the first lockdown of March 2020. That's pretty big. That's pretty significant. What we sort of, the indication there basically is the public just need to be led on it. They kind of need to be told there's a pandemic on. They kind of need to be reminded they've got to do their bit, right? And then they will do it. Otherwise, they won't. And the impression I get here is that government messaging just needs to sharpen itself, just needs to keep warning the public. They spent the past few months, saying the good times are here and there's nothing to worry about. And now they sort of just jump on you with new restrictions without much prior warning, not really much prior warning. And the public, while they will be compliant, they're not idiots. They are less enthused about them than they've ever been, I would say.
And Ben, what about how the smaller parties are getting on? We had a by-election last week, and there's another bigger by-election coming up in North Shropshire. How, and I suppose the Liberal Democrats are hoping they might be able to clinch a victory there with this sort of collapse in confidence in the Conservatives. How are they doing? How's that comparing with the Greens and so on?
So nationally, the Greens are doing okay. So you had the COP26 conference, and it's fair to say that that conference did help the Green numbers. So the Greens peaked at the start of November at 8% in our poll tracker. They're now sitting closer to 6%, a bit of a drift downwards. They were once overtaking the Liberal Democrats in some polls. Now they are not in most, bar YouGov. If you only pay attention to YouGov, the Greens are ahead. If you pay attention to all pollsters, the Greens are quite behind. In terms of by-elections, you know, Old Bexley and Sidcup, 10-point or 11-point swing to Labour. That was mostly down, as what we saw in national polls. Tory vote is staying at home. Labour's base not really moving anywhere, and so Labour gains by default. Nothing really happened there. But it was a good instance of basically Liberal, Democrat and Green voters going for the best opposition to the Conservatives. It was quite effective, wasn't it? You're seeing sort of some, I wouldn't say progressive alliance, because it's not really a progressive alliance, but it is kind of like voters know who to vote for. In North Shropshire, however, you have the sort of, the water's been a bit muddied, hasn't it? You have Labour campaigns now sort of saying, we're second and we're in the running. They were briefing once, weren't they? One of the campaigners, at least, were briefing poll numbers which had them in second, whilst Liberal Democrat campaign on the ground is very bullish about their chances. But just bear in mind about North Shropshire, whilst obviously there will be a backlash to the sleaze of Owen Paterson and generally the sleaze of the Conservative Party and the Prime Minister, but always remember North Shropshire voted Leave quite heavily and is very rural. It's quite socially conservative in terms of its attitudes. It's not, you know, fertile ground for the Liberal Democrats per se, but there will be a backlash nonetheless. My inkling at the moment really is that whilst the Lib Dems are going to definitely gain and they probably will come second, I just wouldn't be sure they win it by virtue of it being a Leave seat. And that still matters in the eyes, in the minds of most voters.
That's so interesting. And before we move on to our second section, Ben, I don't know if you saw the news that the cost of a Christmas dinner has jumped 3%. And I know you spoke about the cost of living and how that will feature in voters' minds in your very good video about whether or not the Prime Minister could survive a Christmas lockdown. Are the public feeling pinched?
Yes, this is one of those things where we've, you know, normally public opinion rarely changes about the fundamentals of who's the best party on the economy. It's always the Conservatives. Well, since 2013, at least. And that kind of stuff. We're now seeing change on some things. Firstly, what do the public rank as important to what the economy is? So, you know, normally You've been in this job far longer than I have. And since time immemorial, the economy has always been twinned with debt and deficit, right? Yeah. So, it's always been twinned with debt and deficit.
I remember when Christmas dinner was 50p.
Oh, I wasn't presuming your age there. I do apologize. I don't really know how old you are anyway, but I'm only at the tender age of 26, but I'm one of those nerds who remembers the Omnishambles budget of 2012.
And, okay, we'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
No, I'm joking.
Yeah, so the economy generally is seen as, in the eyes of voters, when the voters think of the economy, they think of debts, deficit, the issues on which the Conservatives reign supreme, right? And cost of living, though the slogan cost of living crisis did play a lot with voters, it wasn't often the key theme of the economy. Now we're seeing that change. Voters, when they think of the economy, they think of house prices, cost of living, they think of inflation. And people are feeling the pinch. You're having, I call it, one YouGov poll a few weeks ago had the vast majority of people noticing price rises in their shops. They were noticing they were having to spend more. They were noticing they were having to fork out more for general day-to-day things and events. And when you have a public which spends less time thinking about debt and deficit, the issues of which the Conservatives are dominant, and more time thinking about their general personal household budgets, you're going to have a country that is not so sure about the Conservatives being the best party to handle the economy. What my take from that, therefore, is you in the next few months, we know prices are going to rise big time next few months. We know wages are going to, the pinch from wages is going to start to be felt. I really think there's sort of like an opening for Labour here on the economy, because the public no longer view it through the Conservative lens anymore.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times.
underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
And now's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Ben. Yeah, we've got a number of interesting questions. We've got three for you, Ben, if you don't mind. The first one we already touched on in part one, but how useful is snap polling really? You were mentioning that often that represents a bit more of an impulsive decision on the part of voters, and it maybe is slightly inflated. But is there a value in it given that potential inflation?
Yeah, and it sort of tell you the direction of public opinion, the direction of what people are most vexed by. You know, so you have certain debates, you have a snap poll after a debate, who won it, what kind of messages resonated well. And you can use those messages in your campaigns in the weeks and months later, but don't take them as good as the public's final decision. It is kind of just like testing the water. It's kind of just like a test of what is their instinctive view. What is their, as you say yourself, the impulse view. It's not a long-term thing. You know, what we saw with the Redfield and Wilter poll in the immediate aftermath of Wednesday, the chaos of Wednesday, that was a Tory party, a Tory base that had lost confidence in its prime minister. That's not a good sign, but it wasn't a sign of voters turning to Labour. So really not good news for the Conservatives with these snap polls, but don't take it as good that we're going to be seeing 4-point Labour leads in the weeks and months to come. We've got to wait for those 4-point Labour leads in the weeks and months to come. As to whether they happen, I don't really know.
Thanks. And on Scottish independence, we have a question. What's going on with the polls swaying from one side to another in what they call an annual slow roller coaster? And what do you make of the demographic time bomb where unionists are older and separatists are younger?
Yeah. So on Scottish independence, we saw from about just from the aftermath of the referendum in 2014 through to the end of 2019, pretty unshaken leads for no. More Scots were keen on their country remaining part of the UK than not. Now, three things, however, in recent time have caused that change near the end of 2019 throughout much of 2020. We are now seeing, not in all polls, but some polls, leads for yes. And three things have sort of triggered that upswing for yes. One, Brexit. Two, COVID-19. And three, Nicola Sturgeon. So one, Brexit. Brexit happened. And snap polling I alluded to earlier indicates, taken in isolation, it can be the issue that sets Scots on a course for independence. It's the equivalent bogeyman issue that the Leave campaign had in 2016. The Leave campaign had immigration. The Scottish independence campaign has Brexit. But then you have to bear in mind, will Brexit play a part in the next referendum to come? We don't really know that yet. So in 2019, what we saw was that the more Scots and Scottish media outlets talked about Brexit, the less unionists were certain of their voting intention. Point number two, COVID-19 happened. Scots generally saw their government as handling the crisis better than the powers that be in Westminster, even on the occasions when the policies were virtually identical. And three, Nicola Sturgeon. She is polled apart from Boris Johnson in terms of presentation and perceived ability. And she was, to a lot of voters, the image of what an independent Scotland could be. And as a consequence of those three things, throughout much of 2020, yes had leads in the polls. Unionists, those who backed no in 2014, declared higher than average levels of uncertainty to pollsters. And so yes were in part leading by default. They were also gaining people who voted no in 2014 but remain in 2016. But generally, it was just unionists losing their enthusiasm because Nicola Sturgeon is a great communicator. She's got an excellent image. She does, to a lot of Scots, give the vision of this is what an independent Scotland could look like. Until the chaos of the first few months of this year when she, over the Alex Salmond affair, that it was then that her image began to become damaged. You saw across the whole of the UK, Brits generally holding less favourable views of Nicola Sturgeon than normal, because normally the English quite like Sturgeon. I don't know if you remember in 2015, she was one of the best performing debaters of that, well, what were the big debates? The ones with the four main parties, five main parties, and then the nationalist parties from Scotland and Wales. And she was one of the best performers, and she's quite liked in England. But in after the chaos of the Alex Salmond affair, she started to fall down. So at the moment, you're seeing swings, and I apologise that this question, this answer is slightly longer than that. But the three main drivers of independence at the moment has been COVID, Brexit and Sturgeon. Whether they hang around, we don't really know, because COVID's going to go away. The perceived effectiveness of the Scottish government, that's not going to last forever. Brexit is an issue. That's not going to stay in the minds of the Scottish public forever. Does the Scottish independence campaign have a bogeyman similar to immigration was the Leave campaign? Not yet. We don't really know. You know, blood and soil Scottish nationalism. It's not enough. It's not enough to get you over 50% plus one. Nicola Sturgeon, whilst has had a reputation damaged, but she's not going to go on, is she? So I really say, are we the demographic time bomb? Unionists are older, separatists are younger. Don't bank on that. Opinions changed.
That's so interesting, Ben. We have a final question, which I don't think was sent in by our own Stephen Bush, but it could have been because this is one of his favourite topics. So what is the correlation historically between leader favourability ratings and margins of wins?
Okay, now this is the very wonky question, and I thank Stephen for sending it in. And this is, I had to get my books out for this, because this is actually something you have to look at quite historically. So the general argument is that if your leader is popular or more popular than the opposition leader, you're going to win. So here's some examples, right? 2015, David Cameron was unpopular. More Brits disliked him than liked him, but he was more popular than Ed Miliband, because Ed Miliband was at the bottom of the pile, but David Cameron was just a little bit higher. They were both smelling of excrement, basically. But David Cameron wasn't as much, right? You've seen that in history. I do apologize. I brought the New Statesman podcast to the gutter, haven't I? Quite literally. I apologize. But in history, we've seen that as well. 1987, Margaret Thatcher. She was, despite being seen as, you know, Iron Lady, great image, all the rest of it, about 60%, she had 60-40 disapproval. 60% of the public didn't like her. The thing going for her, though, was Neil Kinnock. 70-30 disliked him. It was like a 10-point difference there. And in terms of preference for Prime Minister, Mrs. Thatcher always came away miles ahead of Mr. Kinnock there. The same with Cameron and Brown. Cameron had better perceived prime ministerial qualities than Gordon Brown. And when it comes to Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer, though, we have two issues where they are both unpopular, in that, like David Cameron and Ed Miliband, but you have Boris Johnson ahead on preferred prime minister. In terms of net favourability, Starmer's ahead, so that the gap between popular and unpopular is narrower than the gap between unpopular and popular for Boris Johnson. But Boris Johnson leads on preferred prime minister. The thing that is going and also not going for Keir Starmer is that 3 in 10 don't have an opinion of him, right? It was 1 in 10 for Jeremy Corbyn. It was 1 in 10 for Ed Miliband. It was 3 in 10 for David Cameron. You know, at this point in his leadership, not many people had an opinion of David Cameron until Gordon Brown bottled the snap election of 08. Right. And so
is that what explains that discrepancy then between the preferred prime minister ratings versus their net favorability? Because otherwise, yeah. I think that wouldn't make much sense to people.
Yeah, I would answer yes to that. The simple fact is that Keir Starmer hasn't had much of an impact with the public at the moment. And so he is not seen as prime ministerial material yet. David Cameron, ditto, I would say. And going right back to the 1970s, in 1979, James Callaghan always led on the public's preference for prime minister. Margaret Thatcher didn't, partly because Margaret Thatcher was a bit of a misnomer in the eyes of much of the public. She wasn't exactly a love-hate figure in 1979. Public weren't sure of what to think of her. But that didn't matter, did it? Because the Labour Party's image was in tatters in 1979 and the public were looking for change. You know, I'm sort of confusing matters here just a little bit, aren't I, with 1979. But I think you get the general gist is that leadership favourability ratings, they're more key sometimes than party voting intention.
Great. Thank you. That was really interesting. Thanks so much, Ben. Thanks for coming on again.
Happy to help.
And don't forget that you can send in any questions that you have for Ben or for us for the You Ask Us at podcasts@newstatesman.co.uk, or you can tweet us.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleagues Alva Ray and Ben Walker. We're produced by Adrian Bradley, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks so much for listening, and don't forget to subscribe and leave us a nice review.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.